So we're looking at the significance of thoughts, their relationship to space, and how to work with them. And to me it's a fascinating excuse me, a fascinating topic, partly because maybe I'm very aware of excuse me, of all the thoughts in all their different forms that cycle through my experience or that are my experience. Some people may not be as focused in on thoughts. That may not be as natural for them to focus there. But part of what the TSK books are saying, and especially now in this material that we're looking at, is that thoughts really do operate in our experience or to shape our experience or as our experience in at a much deeper level than we often imagine. And we do not appreciate the impact, the significance of thoughts, it seems to me, in part because we're not as we don't identify as thoughts. Everything that I think, that I would say was a thought, but I think I'm basing it on some of the things the book says. And that's part of what we want to do this morning to start off with is just get a little more clear on what it means to be talking about thoughts at all. And then that will make it easier for us to look at this question of how thoughts relate to space, because that is really the underlying theme for this chapter and what we're exploring right now. So at the top of page 52, it talks about the role of thoughts on line two. The role of thoughts is the carriers or vehicles for the interpretive structures that give experience continuity. And that's where I'd like us to look for a little while, or what I'd like to talk about for a bit, and hopefully we can have some discussion about that. So in the first place, maybe I should get this clear. I don't know that we talked about it that much last week. There's this underlying question of what counts as a thought, right? So one possibility is that thoughts are always in words. We say something to ourselves, or we hear a voice in our head, something like that. And a lot of people seem to assume that that's what thoughts are. Let's bring up the second major example that gets used, and that is the thought as a vision. So if I ask you to think of your mother, seems to be the example I always use, then for most people, what happens is an image of your mother pops into your head. And that certainly seems to count as a thought also. But as we go about our days and our activities, thoughts play a bigger role, and that's really what's being pointed to here. So they might be thoughts as words, they might be thoughts as images, they might be thoughts in less well-defined forms, but they play this role that is mentioned here, that they're the carriers or vehicles for the interpretive structures that give experience continuity. So this is one of these great sentences, or in this case it's actually half a sentence, that has so much packed into it if you really stop and investigate it. Thoughts are the carriers or vehicles for interpretive structures. So we need to think about what that means, an interpretive structure. And then those interpretive structures give experience continuity. Let me give a few examples to suggest what I understand by an interpretive structure. And maybe you would like to question that or add to that or give other examples. I think it's really helpful to to expand our sense of what's going on when we think, and of the of and how that relates to these interpretive structures. And actually, I will give you an example of that, which is not really maybe not the right place to start, but I'm going to. This morning, I was really tired. So here in California where I am, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. So at about 7 o'clock, I was up and I'd taken care of some business and so on. But I felt really just tired, not exactly sleepy, just tired. And I sat in my chair and I settled into what I think in psychology is called a hypnagogic state. I always confuse hypnagogic and hypnopompic, but if I'm right that it's hypnagogic, this is the state when you're not really asleep, but you're right on the edge, you're on the border between being awake and asleep. And the characteristic of that state is that there are these kind of dreamlike images and situations that pass through your mind. They're like any one of them is capable of becoming a dream. But it isn't quite. If it were a dream, then you'd be asleep. But what characterizes it, and so I'm assuming that people know what I'm talking about and have had that experience. And sometimes hypnopompic, if I remember correctly, is when you're waking up and it's the same thing and you're not quite awake. So it's the opposite of hypnagogic. But both of them, each of them, has this same structure of not quite awake, not quite asleep. It's a borderline situation. And it's actually a very interesting situation. A good friend of mine said once that she had spent hours at a certain point in her practice trying. She'd lie down on the couch in the afternoon. She was at home taking care of her children, so sometimes she had that opportunity. And she'd let herself go into this almost sleeping state. And actually, daytime, it seems to be a good time to do this rather than lying in bed at night. But what happens is that whole situations come up, you know, and dreams are like that, right? A dream is a whole world that you enter into. And when it's this hypnagogic state, you're a little bit more able to notice that because it's not quite a dream. So when you're in a dream, typically, you just accept the dream as being reality. But when you're in this other state, you see how the world is taking shape. And it can be a very richly textured world, and it has all these different dimensions to it. And that is just an example of an interpretive structure, you know, a thought as an interpretive structure. So in this case, I guess you'd have to say the dream is the one is what's becoming the interpretive structure. But I bring that up partly because it just is from my experience an hour ago, but partly because I think it's easy to see it in that case. But ordinarily, what we're talking about, when we're looking at thoughts, are not these fully formed kind of dream worlds. But nonetheless, there's an underlying interpretive structure going on. So, if I imagine, for instance, driving on a highway, and I see I see being on the highway and the cars around me, and the landscape perhaps, and I know that I'm on a road, and I know that road connects to other roads. And probably, depending on how I'm imagining it, maybe I'm thinking of some particular place that I'm going, maybe not. All of that is an example, it seems to me, of an interpretive structure. Or let's say I walk into a restaurant and I sit down and I order a meal. There's a whole kind of social structure in that case. You know, the example of the highway is, in part, perhaps you could say a kind of technological structure. I mean, roads are built to connect with each other and get you from one place to another. It's partly sociology. But if I walk into a restaurant, there's a whole structure in place where I understand what the waiter is supposed to do. I understand what my role is. I understand what it means to order food, that I'm expected to pay at the end. The waiter understands that when I ask for a particular dish, I want it served to me on a plate, and I want it served, you know, if it's a warm meal, I want it served warm, and so on. None of that needs to be said. It's just an exchange that we have. And in that exchange, all of this is presupposed. It's kind of the background. And I think, again, that's sort of pointing toward what it means to talk about an interpretive structure that gives experience continuity. And if I order a meal in a restaurant, I'm setting in chain in what's the word? Setting in train a whole set of events that are going to happen. You know, the waiter's going to start bringing me the food, and at the end I'm going to pay, and all those different things. So one particular interaction in that case creates this whole structure, which has its own continuity. And again, thoughts are like that, even though this example of ordering food in a restaurant is not really a thought, but when we think, examples are like that. So suppose that I think about how I'm going to go shopping later today, right? That thought, again, creates an interpretive structure, and in the background are all these things about shopping and stores, but it also has to do with my plan for the day, and you know, I'm going to buy food that I'm going to eat during the week, and so all of that is involved. Again, there's kind of an interpretive structure. So Michael's made a comment here. Let's take a look. Perhaps the two roles of thought, the inhalation of the mind. I'm not sure what you mean by inhalation. Well, yeah, you're coming up to oxygen. Okay. The inhalation of the mind and the carrier of the mental structures on which we rely are like the role of water for a fish, the source of oxygen in the milieu in which she swims, and the role of air for us, the source of oxygen and the milieu that allows us to have a world in which to live. Okay, well, this milieu idea, that seems exactly right to me, that this thoughts give us a world in which we live. And if we weren't thinking, the world would not come into being. So that may sound a little strange, but the basic idea is that we live in a meaningful structure, and thoughts are what create that meaning. Thoughts, or at least thoughts, are what trigger that meaning. You know, I think sometimes we have a thought, and it's a thought that we've had, you know, 100,000 times in our life. It's just the same old thought, but just thinking it triggers all of that. We don't need to think out all the consequences or work out all the consequences. But I'm not sure, Michael, I understand about the inhalation of the mind, or the source, you know, the thoughts as a source of oxygen, essentially. Could you maybe say something about that, or write something about that, just to clarify it?
May not make sense, but I was just thinking that the mind needs thought like the body needs oxygen,
Okay.
and along with that, you get much more. In the case of the mind, you have these you build up a world because of all the secondary stuff that thought is carrying.
Right.
And in the case of, say, our body, we would explode if we lived in a vacuum. So you get these side effects of, we would die if we don't breathe for 4 minutes, but also we would explode if we didn't have, if it wasn't also carrying the environment of our planet.
Right.
Just something like that.
Right. Okay, no, I think I understand that, and that that does make sense to me. It brings up a question that is perhaps worth considering. People will typically say, remember last week we were looking at this question. Rinpoche writes, "If we look carefully, observe carefully, we'll see that we're almost always thinking." And we looked at that, and we had a good discussion around that question. So maybe I'm returning to some old territory, but typically people will say that they aren't always thinking. Because sometimes they're just looking, just observing. Sense experience is coming in. We see the world around us, and so we're not always thinking. But the point here is that whatever we're doing, thoughts are what are framing this interpretive structure. So if I am looking out the window at my garden, it all makes sense to me in terms of a structure in which, it's me and it's my window and it's a garden and the garden needs watering and I'm going to plant some more flowers in the garden and last year there was that storm. All of these things are kind of in the background. We're not necessarily thinking about them, but there's this whole kind of framing story, and that's why it's like a dream. That's why I started with the example of a dream, or something close to a dream, because there's a whole way of making sense of the experience. And when we have a thought, you could say it's not that the thought is that interpretive structure, but as we think, we are letting that structure take form, and then that's what gives meaning to our lives. So it's as though thoughts, to stay with the image that Rinpoche uses about thoughts being the carriers or vehicles, it's as though we are loading into a truck, this whole structure. And the difference is that the structure is what we live in. So that's why Michael's point about it's being a milieu, being like the air we breathe or the water that a fish breathes. I think that's exactly right. So,
Jack,
but yeah. Yes.
could we do that, that thoughts are organizing tendencies? It's an organizing tendency of the self and of the world we inhabit. That thoughts are the, see, in psychology, there's a notion of ego function as opposed to ego identity. And ego function is to organize.
Well, that's interesting. I think that's fine. I mean, that makes sense to me. I'm just thinking about it a little bit. Thoughts
But they're
definitely.
organizing entities.
Right. I wouldn't want that to be understood in too narrow a sense because they also are. It's not as though there's a world presented and then we use thoughts to organize it. The thoughts also present the world. They present the interpretive structure.
I
Okay,
see.
but I do think that this idea that thoughts perform a function which allows us to function or to operate in the world, I think that is a good element, an important element to understand. It maybe relates to the comment that Brigitte makes here, the question. She says, I'm just wondering about mentally disabled persons. They also seem to perceive a world. Of course, nobody of us knows how they are thinking, but when they express themselves, it seems to mirror a slightly different world. Well, yes, I actually just was listening to a talk yesterday. I attended part of a short conference, and one of the speakers made the point that if someone is schizophrenic, and he was talking about how this might be caused by certain brain, problems in the in their what do you say, the structure of their brains. But he said, given the way that the world is presenting for them, schizophrenics are completely rational. They're responding to the world that they experience. And you could say the same thing, it seems to me, about these interpretive structures. That any interpretive structure that we use to make sense of experience, the thought comes along, the structure is there, it's a way of making sense, it's a way of functioning, and everything else follows from that. And we have a natural tendency to act in a consistent and coherent way. So, in Buddhism, the classic example that's a little more narrow is if we are looking at a bowl full of water, a god might see it as a bowl full of nectar, but a being in the hell realms might see it as a burning mass of ugly, I don't know, awful things. It's like that. We have a way of making sense out of the world, and then it manifests. And in a way, maybe that's a good example, the Buddhist example I just gave, because one of the things that thoughts help us do is identify things. We say, "Oh, look at that." We don't say it to ourselves in words, but we say, "Look at that bowl of water," whereas a god is saying, "Look at that bowl of nectar," But it's because there's this underlying interpretive structure. There's the god structure, and there's the human structure, and it crystallizes in the thought, and that's another way of saying that thoughts become the carrier. So the most important interpretive structure, it seems to me, is the structure of the self. We make sense of the world in terms of our role at the center of our lives. So if we're thinking about getting a new job, let's say, we're wondering whether maybe we should find a new job or move to a different city or something like that. All of that only makes sense in terms of an interpretive structure about our lives and how they're unfolding. And of course, this helps us understand the second part of this sentence. The interpretive structure gives experience continuity. So there's a nice discussion in Love of Knowledge where Rinpoche, over the course of several chapters actually, discusses different kinds of knowledge. And he says some knowledge looks backward. It makes sense out of things. The sense that it makes is, it describes things. So it's like looking at that bowl of water. We say, okay, look at that bowl of water. We identify it in terms of what we already understand. We identify it in terms of that aspect of the interpretive structure, which has set things up and identified them and labeled them in a certain way. The other aspect is when you're looking ahead and you say, "Oh, I'm going to go shopping today," or maybe I need to think about moving to another city. That's looking forward into the future. And in Love of Knowledge, Rinpoche talks about those as two different forms of knowledge. But it basically is a question of past experience on the one hand and future concerns on the other hand. We wonder or we worry or we hope or we fantasize about what might happen in the future. And that's part of an interpretive structure. And especially it's part of those structures in which we're focused on ourselves. And you might say that that's mostly what's going on. That's what our interpretive structures are usually focused on ourselves. Of course, in a way, it helps to see that more clearly if you think about the unusual case where, let's say, we go to see a movie. And at least in part, we're drawn into the world of that movie, the interpretive structures or the story of that movie. And at least in part, we kind of halfway inhabit it. And so that at that time, we are not the center of the interpretive structure, or at least our role in the interpretive structure is different. But most of the time, we're focused on ourselves. Even in, let's say you're talking with a friend, and the friend is your friend is telling you something about her life, and you are sympathetically involved with that, and in part maybe kind of trying to imagine yourself into the situation for your friend. But you are also reacting in terms of who you are and your past relationship with that person. So all of that is what's going on with interpretive structures, and as it says in the text, built into that are connections and identities that let us make sense of what's happening. So that's the basic structure there. And the text goes on to talk about the fact that in order to do that, thoughts kind of have some raw materials at hand, some building materials. So the image that Rinpoche uses is thoughts have to box the experience and label it before they can become carriers. Okay? And they make use of the materials at hand, the world that's already known. As each thought arises, its content is located or assigned in terms of past experience and future concerns. And that's what we've been talking to. So, talking about. So the key there, or the the conclusion that we'd like to draw from that, because it's so important for what we're looking at. What we're looking at, or what we're interested in, is rediscovering space and the possibility of freedom that space allows. And what we're talking about here is a world in which there really is very little freedom, because everything has been determined in advance, as it says here, grounded in a well-known history and heading toward a presupposed future. So we've got these interpretive structures, and thoughts are the carriers for those structures. So as long as we're thinking in our ordinary way, we're living in a world in which everything has already been set up, and there is no possibility for freedom. So looking in space-centered terms, this is what the last paragraph says. It says, there's no possibility of gaps. Right? Each known thing has its appropriate place, and each new experience arrives ready to be situated within this presupposed order. Right? The thoughts that guide us confirm the situation in which we find ourselves. So the underlying idea, this is very very central to the kind of inquiry that we're doing right now, is that this really is a kind of a spatial structure. Thoughts create a world, and one of the characteristics of a world, you could say in general, I guess, if you're looking at your world, and it's always your world, just about always, it's always your world that you're looking at, or maybe you're trying to understand someone else's world, as Brigitte mentions. The characteristic of a world is that there is a there's there are space and time, right, and knowledge. So this is, it takes us right back to the very basic premise or idea in the TSK vision, which is that if we're trying to make sense of experience, the fundamentals that seem to always be operating are space and time and knowledge. And that's what it means to inhabit a world. You could even say, maybe this is going too far, but I don't think so. You could even say that's what it means to be alive. You're in a situation or a world, and that world, the very fact that we talk about being in a world already presupposes space. And it's a meaningful world which already presupposes time, that it has continuity. Things, if there was no continuity at all, there'd be no possibility of meaning. But that's not what our world is like. So there's space and time, and then there's the awareness of that that's what's going on, and that's the knowledge dimension. So those things are all going on. And the important transition that we're involved with right here, the one that, is a little, goes a little bit against our usual way of thinking about things, is that it's thoughts that set up these worlds. So you could say any world that we inhabit is a thought world. The part of that that goes against our experience is that we think about space. When we think about space, we think about physical space. And that's what most people imagine. If you ask them to describe space, they say, well, the space, our Earth moves through space, or things are located in space, and they're thinking about physical space. This is a broader understanding of what space is, and this is pretty basic, so maybe I don't need to emphasize this point, but the basic idea here is that space is whatever allows, right? It's the allowing dimension of any experience. There's always a space going on. And that's why it makes perfectly good sense. I think most people would agree with this. I mean, most people, meaning people who aren't necessarily involved with TSK, it makes perfectly good sense to talk about space in the world of a dream. In order for there to be a world in a dream, it seems essential. Maybe there are exceptions, but it seems essential that there be space. And ordinarily in dreams, there are events happening in that space. So, the dream world has its own space and time and knowledge. And so it's helpful to think about that because then you realize, well, it's not just this world, this world of physical objects and physical space and events happening. Like, here we are talking, that's an event happening in this physical world. Linear time. So on. So thoughts set that up. When we talk about thoughts being the carriers of interpretive structures, another way to say that would be that thoughts are carriers of a world, an inhabited world, the world that we inhabit. Right? Whenever you have a thought, there is a space and a time connected with it. And so space becomes something much broader, much more rich in possibilities than the usual understanding of space. So I was thinking we could do a short practice. We don't have time for much, but a couple of minutes that's at least related to this point. And it has to do with the fact that thoughts themselves have a funny relationship to space. We may have talked about this before. In modern thought, we're very committed to this idea that there's the physical world, and then there's the self, which doesn't seem to occupy physical space. And in the same way, you could say thoughts don't seem to occupy physical space. It's not as though I can see a thought in front of me. Thoughts are carriers for space, but the space that they carry is not located in some other space. It's certainly not in our physical space, right? You might say, the kind of natural response would be to say, well, no, thoughts are in my head. Right? And that's what I thought we could experiment with for just a couple of minutes. I see that Michael has made another comment, which I missed until now. But let's go ahead and do this practice. So the practice is ask yourself for a couple of minutes now, where are thoughts located? Is it in fact true that they're located in your head? Or what else can you say about it? Let's just go ahead and try that for a couple of minutes. The question is to ask yourself is, when you think, what can you say about where the thought is located? Okay, let's do that for a couple of minutes. Okay. So I'll give people a chance to react to that. Maybe some of you would feel that that's a trick question. If thoughts.
Can I say something? Can I
Yes,
say
yes.
something?
Yeah, Sudhi.
Jack, this is very new. I am feeling that whatever I experience, it's a thought. I mean, anything. But this is new. I'll say 3, 4, 5 weeks, and I don't know how it's going to change. It seems anything that I'm aware of is a thought.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting insight to pursue. You know, in the end, that may shift for you in some way, but it's very consistent with what's being said here, that thoughts are the carriers for our interpretive structures, and it makes it very difficult to imagine what it would be like not to have a thought. Now this goes to Michael's comment here and something we talked about last week too, which has to do with the idea of gaps. So at the end of this reading, it says there's no possibility of gaps. Now it doesn't actually say that. It says in this world of substance and identity, there's no possibility of gaps. And then it says, you know, suppose that a gap does arise, we need to fill it right away. And it talks about the possibility. It says, you know, that's when we talk about nervous breakdowns or madness or identity crisis or genius.
Oh, genius.
Or
See, I
genius.
didn't know what that meant. What that meant? What does that mean?
Well, it means that you know, if we say it's like if the ordinary world rips open, which is the image that's used here, sometimes people would say, well, that's what happens to the great artists. You know, something completely new emerges, or the great scientists, or, you know, I think that's what's being said. Okay. Okay.
Jack,
Yes.
in terms of where thoughts are located,
Yes.
it seemed that it depended upon how it was presented. So when it was a thought that was like a visual, it seemed to be behind my eyes. When the thought seemed to be more of a spoken word, the thought seemed to be located in my throat or my mouth. So it seemed as though thoughts were located wherever they present.
So, what about if you're thinking of, so, you know, let's say you're looking at something. Does that mean the thought is located where the object you're looking at is located? Or is it behind?
It seems that the thought is located behind the eyes.
Okay. You know, there aren't any right answers about these things.
It's located wherever the experience arises, or
Mm-hmm.
the form in
Mm-hmm.
which the experience arises,
Okay. Okay,
determines
good.
its location.
Let's look at a couple of the other comments here. Michael, I'm going to save yours for the end because I want to stay focused on the exercise right now. But you did comment on that too. Any identification, this is Michael, any identification such as location where I might want to place something. So thought comes first, including the head in which I might try to place a thought. Well, yeah, I started to say this is like a trick question, and it might be. You might say, well, in order to have a location for the thought, I have to have a thought in which I can locate it, you know. So that's possible. Let's see. It looks as though this thought, or excuse me, this chat, got communicated indirectly, but it's Sandra. Thoughts are coming from my entire body. I need my toe to wiggle to have the thought it's wiggled. If I think of someone thinking, I think of their entire body, not their head. Well, that's interesting. That's a kind of a that's a good point. It's like if you, you know, so there's that very famous statue that most of you probably know called The Thinker by Rodin, right? And it's the whole body that's doing the thinking, right? And somehow, I mean, you could say part of what he tries to capture in that sculpture is how the body is involved, engaged in the act of thinking. So that's one possible answer also. And Brigitte says, located in space around me, I think, somehow, I claim it then. Okay, so I think if I understand correctly, you're saying the thought is really located all around you, and then you claim it. And maybe it's at that point, I'm saying a little more than you said, maybe it's at that point that it then enters the space of you know, enters the space behind the eyes, let's say, or enters the throat, or but first it seems somehow to be located all around, which would make sense in terms of this model that the thought is the carrier for the whole situation that you find yourself in. Okay, well, I'm not taking sides here. Okay, here's a couple of other points. It's not so much in the body, Brigitte says. So maybe what I said isn't completely right. And Sandra says, okay, the thought also comes from my environment. I wouldn't be thinking of this unless it was suggested in the context of a class listening to you. Well, that's true, but it's maybe a little bit different point because you're asking, well, what causes you to be thinking this thought? And yes, it's this situation that has led you to go in this direction. Maybe that's a part of the space in which the thought occurs. That's fine. So Michael raised a question here, and then we're going to have to end or about gaps and edges. So he's actually looking at this issue of gaps, right? And what we talked about last week is the space between thoughts. He says a cycle of life runs out, and we don't know what's going to come next. We may experience a gap between something that has exhausted itself and something new that has not yet been born. Then we could feel as if we're inhabiting a gap. This may be the way we can overcome limits, not by crossing over, but by letting something new arise. Well, I think it's absolutely true. There's two points. One is this is what you're describing is very similar to the idea of the space between thoughts, which we talked about last week. And last week I a little bit dismissed that, not because it's not important. I just said that it's very difficult. You can't do it in 2 minutes, in my experience, on a telephone call. But if we were doing a TSK intensive, or we had the chance to practice more intensively, then that would be a very interesting thing to explore. And I think it would very much go in the direction that you're describing, Michael. One thing ends, it comes to its natural conclusion, its life cycle is finished, and a thought can have a life cycle too, and we can experiment with that. That's what the abiding in thought exercise that we've been working with for a while is. It's about the life cycle of a thought, you could say. So a thought may, or whatever, any kind of experience may come to an end, and then there's the possibility of a gap before the next experience starts up, and that's where freedom lies. So yeah, I think that is the possibility we're interested in, or well, no, I shouldn't say it that way. One possibility would be that's where we want to look for the possibility of freedom is outside of these worlds of substance and identity. And that's a very fine practice, and it's discussed and suggested in various ways in the TSK books. The other possibility, which is really, I think, more the direction that we're working with right now in this chapter, is to question what it means to have substance and identity. And that's where we're going to go next week. To look at this question about how thoughts communicate the substance of their contents. That's really the issue under investigation for next time. And if it turns out that we can question the substantiality or the no gap, completely identified, completely based on the presupposed form of our experience, if we can question that, then the possibility of freedom is there. And of course, we looked at that in the last chapter and last term on when we looked at appearance as appearance only, or appearance as the appearance of substance without being substance. So that's what we're looking at, but we're going at looking into it in terms of the role of thoughts in structuring that substantiality. Okay, well, sorry I kept you a little late today, but I think it's fruitful to explore these things. So next week we have a little bit longer reading. We have several pages, so we'll have to figure out a way to deal with it all. Well, maybe dealing isn't so important.